This is March Twisdale, and I'd like to welcome you to Prose, Poetry, and Purpose. You are listening to Voice of Vashon, KVSH 101.9 FM. All shows are also available on demand at voiceofvashon.org, or you can download the app. Today, you'll be listening to my interviews with two island authors, Karen Dale, the mistress of island gardening, and Melissa McCann, a vibrantly wicked sci-fi and fantasy diva. And of course, at the end of the show, I will share one more of my flash fiction vignettes from my Vashon After the Change series. But first, let's plug into my interview with Melissa McCann.
Alrighty, so we are going to be talking about Symbiont. I think I pronounced that correctly,
yes.
Right? Good. And if I understand correctly, about 15 years ago, coming out of college, you did a lot of writing. Mm-hmm. And you released a handful of historical romance novels of the short and fluffy variety, you were telling me. And then a number of standalone sci-fi novels, such as Symbiont, all of which now, about 15 years later, are being re-released, new cover art, and some small revisions thrown in there.
Yeah.
Okay. So, well, why don't we dive into Symbiont then for a minute?
Mm-hmm.
And but I would like, if you don't mind, to touch on some of your other novels. Maybe you could throw out some of the names near the end of the interview as well, so people have a sense. So Symbiont, first of all, I just totally love this character. Why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about the protagonist of Symbiont?
Well, she was an actress. Generally does three holoplays a year. Her break is to do a silly comedy, and the rest of the time she does serious drama.
Right. And this is in the future. So would you call it just sci-fi, or is it utopian or dystopian as well?
I would say just sci-fi.
Okay.
You know, you try to mix in some good things that may happen in the future and some of the problems that you think may be continuing from the present or getting worse, or are brand new.
Right. It is really funny, actually. You make a good point that when we read a dystopian novel and it's usually about all the troublesome bad things that are happening, and we're like, oh yeah, that might happen in the future. And I'm always thinking, yeah, but it's already happened in the past, and in some countries of the world is happening currently.
Uh-huh.
You know, like if you think of the Hunger Games, for example, there's a lot of places in the world right now that are just about as desperate as what that world is dealing with. So I like how you just said you're carrying the issues of today forward into the future, because they're already here, aren't they?
Yeah.
Some of the main issues that you wanted to cover in this, I mean, you know, it's this really cool story, and it stands all on its own, but you didn't just write it because you wanted to just write a fun story. You also sort of wanted to bring a message to your readers.
I think always first I want to write a fun story.
Mm-hmm.
And the issues that come into a story are, you know, the things that I read about, the things that I'm interested in. I read a lot of nonfiction, sociology, psychology, politics, economics, and science. You know, none of it really in depth, but broad rather than deep.
Right. Renaissance woman, as it were.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
And it's kind of inevitable that because those are the things that you know about, that's what you write about.
That's where the tension comes from.
Yeah.
Yeah, because the real world has a lot of tension.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this story, Symbiont, is set, you said, about 50 years in the future,
50
roughly.
Years in the future.
And it's local. It's Seattle.
Yeah. I really wanted to have, you know, we keep hearing about the big earthquake that's going to hit like within the next 500 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was interesting. And so I was reading about the Pacific Plate and the fault line that runs under Seattle.
Right.
And then reading a little bit about you know, Seattle is built on silt, especially down on the waterfront. And you get earthquake vibrations through there, and the silt liquefies.
I did not know that.
Yeah, I thought that was cool.
Yeah, no, and so basically you have a bunch of, what is like, you have a bunch of teeny, teeny little grains that somehow are holding each other up, but when they shake, they like settle? Or how does it liquefy?
They're suspended in water because it's silt.
Right.
Oh, gosh, I don't know the
details.
No,
but that makes sense, doesn't it? That the water's like in little tiny bumps mixed in with all those. And then if you shake it enough, the water's going to go squirt in different directions. And interesting.
Yeah, the little particles are kind of lubricated by the water.
Right.
So when the water starts to vibrate, the little particles start to shift. They're no longer stuck together as tightly.
Wow. And how much of the front of Seattle is on silt? Like just the docks, or is it like up to First Street or Second?
Well, if you think about the Seattle Underground, where things kept sinking and so they would build up over the top of it, that area goes up through Pike Place Market. I'm not sure exactly how far it goes.
Right.
Oh, I'm thinking of Pioneer Square is where that tour starts. But yeah, as you go further up, you realize that like some of the department stores have just gone ahead and opened up lower levels and are using them as sub-basements. And they link up to the underground bus system that's kind of using that same underground structure.
So, okay, so you took something in the local area and you went ahead and just sort of fast-forwarded through an event that we all know is going to happen.
Yeah.
I mean, and it's interesting to me. There was a National Geographic article that came out recently. I think it was this month or last month. And it's talking about Africa being the new breadbasket. Uh-huh. And what it says is by 2050, we will need to feed 2 billion more people. Here's how we're going to do it. Right.
Uh-huh.
And I looked at that and I thought, whoa, wait a minute. The next article is going to say, by 2100, we need to feed 4 billion more people. It's like at some point, we're just never going to get to a trillion people on this planet. At some point, that needs to stop. And then I thought, well, right now there's already enough people on the planet. Do we really want to wait longer before we, you know, deal with that?
Right.
So that right there, you know, those things come up and then you go, oh, I could write a novel about that.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, and for me, that's the setting. Mm-hmm. Of your, you know, I write about people.
Yes.
And
the name of your protagonist, Emma, is a really interesting one. And how do you spell the last name again?
Sloan, S-L-O-A-N.
O-A-N, right. So is that her stage name or is that her birth name? Because she's very well known in this world, right? Very famous actress.
I don't know.
Oh, I'm sorry.
She never told me.
Okay. All right. So, then you know what? Every actress deserves to have a few secrets from the public.
Yes.
So she is very well known and very well regarded. And as an actress, what I find fascinating about this is the construct that you brought into this novel, where she is continually analyzing the people around her through the lens of an actress or an actor. It's like, I love how she'll be like, ooh, why is that person acting that way? Well, does that make them the hero or does that make them the villain? And she's literally thinking this to herself, which when you're actually, you know, involved in theater, you think that way.
Mm-hmm.
So I really love how you didn't just make her an actress and then move on as just a person. You enriched her by bringing her whole life of experience as an actress with her, and she thinks like an actress. What inspired that?
You know, every character has to have something that makes them distinct and fun and interesting. You know, and I think in those terms, to some extent, I spend a lot of time thinking about stories and story structure and how stories work in the human brain and the neurology of storytelling. So since I'm spending so much time thinking about telling stories, it just seemed logical that the character who's an actress might as well be thinking about that too.
Right. You're a writer. You think that way. She's an, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Well, and she spent her whole life acting. At one point she mentions that she played triplets in The Parent Trap. So, you know, she was fairly young.
Triplets in The Parent Trap. Now, wait a minute. But Parent Trap was actually a while ago with... So is this a futuristic remake of Parent Trap? Okay.
Yeah. Lots of remakes of things. She played Batman at one point.
Yeah. See, I'm only a third of the way through.
Oh, I shouldn't spoil it for you.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's, you know, so far, I don't think those are major spoilers. But
no.
So she has this skin... Now, I don't want to spoil it for our my listeners. Let's see here. Okay. So, okay. Well, it says it on the back.
Yes. And right. That's there, the first so thing that happens to her.
Okay, right. So she's injured. She's burned. And they end up taking a bioengineered symbiotic organism is used to replace her skin because she's refusing the skin grafts. They're not working.
Yeah.
And now bioengineered, I'm just curious because I haven't gotten into the book far enough to know. Is this touching at all upon current day issues around bioengineering, or is that just a sci-fi piece?
I tell people that the heroine is a genetically engineered organism. Partly that was, I'm told that lots of writers do this. I had a dream one night. There was this, you know, this, I was wearing this skin, had to learn how to control it and deal with it. And who was I when I had this, was wearing this ugly thing? And, you know, and the climax of the dream is when I was suddenly able to make it look like me again.
Okay.
Yeah. And I don't know.
That is awesome.
I don't know what that means exactly, wow.
But
you know.
That is so cool.
Yeah. Well, and dreams are one of those universal Jungian archetypal, when you're having a really intense emotional dream, there's a good chance it'll make a good story.
Well, it's funny because you're right. We do hear that writers do this a lot. Stephanie Meyer is one of the most famous, probably recent authors to talk about that. I mean, Suzanne Collins doesn't say, I had a dream about the Hunger Games, but supposedly it was this dream that, you know, Stephanie Meyer had that led to the entire Twilight series, which was massively famous. But what's really funny is I don't think people typically want to talk about that so much. It's actually sort of personal.
Yeah.
So I think it's really cool that you shared, and thank you for doing that, because my novel, The Ghost Lords, and the entire series, even though it's 99.99% all created novel, it also really came about over about a year and a half. I had four dreams. And at the end of them, I just was laying there one morning when I woke up from one. I'm like, I have to do something about this. It was the same recurring concept occurring in a dream.
Yeah.
Exact same emotional component. And so my entire novel basically also came about because I wanted to do something about this dream.
Oh, but first, I'd like to remind our listeners that they're currently tuned into our island's own Voice of Vashon FM station, 101.9 KVSH. This is Prose, Poetry, and Purpose, and I'm currently speaking with the witty and fascinating Melissa McCann, local writer extraordinaire. So, back to our discussion of dreams as inspiration for authors. Right, Melissa?
Yeah. Wow. Well, and the ones that make the best stories are the ones where you lay there and you don't want to wake up.
Right.
So you're just right on that cusp of waking up, and you start to get lucid so you can kind of control the dream and stay in it.
Yep.
Until your dogs start jumping up and down on your head and telling you it's breakfast time.
Right. Yeah. Right. Well, and I did some research actually into lucid dreaming because it comes up in the novel that she's going to wonder, am I having lucid dreams or is something else going on? Uh-huh. You know, and yeah, and lucid dreaming is fascinating. The work they did at Stanford University on that.
Oh.
And it's like they spent decades trying to research how you could induce lucid dreaming and create it on purpose because it's such an enjoyable experience in a way.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, and that would be great for virtual reality devices.
Ooh.
When we're, yes, in the future when we're plugging our video games directly into our brains.
Right.
You know, that would be real nice.
Yeah.
I may just finally fall behind the technological curve at that point. I'm not sure I'm into that.
No. My brother, who's like in his think he's almost 30, and really into math, and he knows lots about that stuff. He's got a master's, and he's super, you know, his brain does all those things that my brain cannot do. Mm-hmm. And one of the things he talks about sometimes is robotics and the future of robotics and, you know, the idea of all the fields with all the food being grown, with being harvested by robots so that people don't have to do it. The funny thing is that while he's envisioning that as this utopian future because farming must suck, you know, and he doesn't do farming. I don't even think he has plants. Yeah, but but you've got me on the other end with my little 5 acres, and I'm out there just loving my plants and growing food. And so it is really, sci-fi is really on the cusp of this, like, what direction are we going to go? You know, are we, you know, or how can we blend the benefits of technology and science while not losing the roots that we evolved from and all the benefits of being in tune with nature and the biorhythms of our body and all that. Does this woman in Symbiont come to a place where she's in balance?
Yeah. It takes a while, obviously.
Don't give anything away.
Yeah.
Well, that's what basically the whole book's sort of about.
Yeah.
Seeking balance in a way.
Well, yeah. And I tend to tell those stories about forming communities and looking at things as an outsider and gradually becoming an insider, usually by creating your own kind of community of like-minded people.
Right. Yeah. It's not, there's,
you know, like
out
all the Symbionts.
Right. Yeah. Well, and there's selling out to become an insider where you mask who you are, you want to pass, you want, you know. And then there's, sounds like, a more holistic formation of a group that is more open-minded to more diversity. So you become an insider because they broaden their minds rather than because you narrow yourself.
Yeah. And that's hard to do. You know, I've been really missing graduate school lately, because I'm spending all my time in my garden, and I don't have that other intellectual thing where you sit around talking about books and literature, you know, in more of a technical way rather than the kind of touchy-feely, which is good, too.
Right.
Trying to find that balance, and I'm not sure whether... I definitely was not very balanced in graduate school, but oh my God.
You didn't have a plant either?
No. Well, actually, I kept a rabbit in my apartment.
My brother has 2 rats.
I loved the person that I was in graduate school, but I really knew I was faking it. I miss her, but... I am also so deliriously happy in my garden, and it's just such a joyful experience. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, I'm just really hating that I'm not also that other person.
Right. Too much of a good thing, right? Too much of anything. One of the themes in my life that's really developed over the past decade that I bet you're going to relate to as well is that less really is more. And it's funny because it applies to everything. You think it's going to apply only in one direction, but it doesn't. Because, like, for your situation, I'm hearing that, you know, a little bit less intensity on one area ends up creating more time for some other aspects of yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think you are so not alone. You're the fourth person that I can think of right now this week who has made the comment to me of, oh my gosh, I'm stuck in my garden. And three of these women who mentioned that to me were writers. And they were all saying, I haven't been able to write because the demands of this huge, growing mass of vegetation, you know, that we have this relationship with.
And in my yard, that's mostly blackberries and nettles is them. Oh. So I'm doing epic battle with my garden.
I'm sorry. Yeah. But we're all there. I find, like, those people who write every single day, like Stephen King says he writes 2,000 words every day. It doesn't matter if it's garbage, if it's not garbage.
Bless his heart.
I know, really. Well, there you go. That's why he's so prolific. But I keep thinking to myself, someone else is cleaning his house and someone is managing his yard and someone is driving his kids everywhere they need to go. For me, once the gardening season explodes, it's really hard.
Oh, yeah. You know? It eats your life.
It does. And then summer with children, I'm running them around. But fall and winter are great riding times because there's not as much going on. So it's, I don't know, each season, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So you, my lovely dear, can be found most Saturdays hanging out at the farmer's market here on Vashon with your mom and some other lovely writers. Different people come on different Saturdays. And so if people have questions or if they want to take a look and flip through this book and see some of the stuff that I've been seeing, they can swing by the market.
Yes. And it's also available on Kindle. So I don't carry paper books anymore. I'm a science fiction enthusiast. I want my technology.
Right.
I love being able to carry 2,000 books on my Kindle everywhere I go.
Oh, just stop. I'd be like three suitcases everywhere I go. No, I'm kidding. My son just actually got a Kindle from his aunt when he was down visiting family in California. And she hands him this Kindle and says, I'm not using it here. You can have it, right? So he gets off the plane and I pick him up. He flew by himself for the first time. Yay. And he's all excited about this. And we're sitting there on the bus and he says, oh, look, she's got these books on here already. And there's 50 Shades of Grey.
Uh-oh.
And I'm like, okay, someone's either he's already read it or I'm going to be deleting it soon. Or I'll say, read it, let's talk. One or the other, right?
Yes.
But I don't even know how to use a Kindle. You and I need to get together. You need to show me how to use this Kindle. I have no clue at all.
They're really very simple. Oh,
that's
and
what
it's
I hear.
Wonderful to be able to carry all my books with me. It's like a security blanket.
Right. Says the sci-fi writer. Okay. Was there anything we forgot to talk about?
Don't think so.
Okie doke. Beautiful. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you.
All right.
And now we're going to switch gears a bit, traveling from a fictional sci-fi view of the future of Seattle into an equally surprising historical view of gardening here on Vashon Island. If you've lived here for a while and you think you know the island, I think we still have some surprises in store for you. If you're just tuning in, welcome to Prose, Poetry, and Purpose on Voice of Vashon's new FM station 101.9 KVSH. I'm March Twisdale, host and producer. Welcome to the show. I'm about to dive into my second interview of the hour with Karen Dale, author of Garden on Vashon. How are you doing today?
Pretty good, March. Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much for coming by the studio today. And I understand you also write a blog called Garden on Vashon, which can be found on the Beachcombers website, correct?
That's right. I've been writing that for the last 3 years. It has 125 entries over the last 3 years, all about gardening here on Vashon.
Now, does that include when you came out to visit me a number of years ago? That feels longer than 3 years ago.
That was
different?
That was longer ago. And in fact, that was the first year that I started writing. And I'll tell you how that writing and how the book got started.
Sure, that'd be great.
After the turn of the century, nobody had really done much writing. And certainly there's no consistent garden columnists in any of our media. So I'd been stewing about that for a while. And then in that horrible winter in December 2008 happened to us where we had a whiteout that lasted for 3 weeks.
Right.
Power
I really
was
enjoyed
out.
That. I actually like it when that happens, but go ahead.
I enjoyed it to a point
because
I have this library of books about gardening and I dove straight back into them to sort of save myself in this white world. I could go into the perpetual world of June and roses and vegetables. So I was reading that, and then I also read for the first time Michael Pollan's book, The Omnivore's Dilemma.
That's right.
A wonderful nonfiction book where he goes to people who are experts, hangs out with them, talks to them about what they do and what their farm or their garden or their kitchen, how that works.
He interviewed Polyface Farm for that book, didn't he?
He sure did.
Oh,
right.
I love that farm.
Yes. And that style of nonfiction writing suggested to me that if he could go to people and find out what works for them, why mm-hmm. couldn't somebody go to Vashon Islanders mm-hmm. and see what works on the island on Island Gardens?
Right.
So when that whiteout ended in about February, I called the Beachcomber and I said, would you like to have an article on starting seeds? And it was that whole season where Michelle Obama was putting a vegetable garden into the White House mm-hmm. lawn. And locally, Nancy Lewis Williams and was starting a vegetable growing class that was so big, she had to schedule a second one.
Wow.
Yeah. And Kathy Fulton was starting her compost festivals in the fall.
Right.
So there was a gestalt, a feeling rising up that everybody wanted to do gardening
things. We still had the worm farm on the island then too, right? The guy who was making all the worms and everything.
I'm like, not sure if he still does.
But I remember there was this period of time where a lot was happening.
Yes, yes. And it still is. There's mm-hmm. reached a level of maturity right now. So in that February, I wrote my first article, which was about starting seeds. And I remember coming to your house and seeing yeah. your little patch of garden and seeing your wonderful starts basking in a south-facing window that
yeah.
were twice the size of mine and being so jealous.
Oh, I remember that too. I had forgotten that part.
So that was the beginning of the writing. Afterwards, right. the Beachcomber asked me to write a blog, which I started, and I really enjoyed that. But that's more of a visual, colorful, picture-oriented presentation. And
right.
I thought we needed something a little more long-lasting, a little more around the calendar year, and also going back in time, kind of a link
right.
back to Pamela Woodruff's 1990s Tales of the Tilth to bring the picture of the island up to date.
Mm-hmm. And now we have Garden on Vashon.
We do have Garden on Vashon.
We do.
Right.
Which you read when we had, when the Vashon Writers Group had their first reading at the library, like practically the day the new library opened.
Mm-hmm.
I found it so fascinating listening to you reading. It was like, what, in 7 minutes, I learned so much more than I had learned in a decade about the Beale greenhouses. And I think you made the point earlier at some point when we were chatting about how we can live right next door to someone who's doing something amazing. We can be completely clueless that it's happening, you know, just 3 acres away. What does your book do for the island with regard to raising awareness of our resources and stuff?
Well, it is true that we can all live down our driveways in our 5-acre bubbles and do things without noticing our neighbors or feeling like much of a community. And I think it is sort of the individual drive that I want to go dig in the dirt
mm-hmm.
that brings us here. But local knowledge has to come from our neighbors, from
mm-hmm.
our locale. And there's a big pool of experts here on the island who really understand how Vashon works, and yet no one had brought that into one place.
Right.
That's part of my source, my knowledge base for the book. I also wanted to do something that, well, Phil McCormick back in 1938 did a romp around the island, if he could walk around the island 24 hours. And here,
oh.
all these separate little communities came down to cheer him on. And Bruce Holman, in his history book about Vashon, makes the point that this is a unifying activity.
Right.
People felt like they lived on one island rather than in Lisabula or Burton or Raycoma or the
right.
North End. So a lot of people, when they've read the book, they tell me, oh, I read about my friends. I didn't know that that's what they were doing. I didn't realize my soils were down in that zone.
Right.
So to me, my hope was that this gives readers a more unified picture of the island, how its systems work, community systems, ecological systems, growing systems, and what we came from
mm-hmm.
our agricultural past through a sort of dormancy of the 70s and 80s and into a refreshed agricultural and gardening scene here in the 1990s, 20s, and 20-teens.
Right. What I really like about the point you just made is, well, there's actually a novel I'm reading right now. I believe it's called Queen of the Tearling. And fabulous story. You know, it's another world. It's just great. It's wonderful. But, of course, in it, the author is putting in little teeny tiny thoughts that are really relevant to the current day and issues that we're facing in today. And one of the things that a lot of her character has thoughts about, and characters that have mentored her protagonists have thoughts about, is the concept that the future is the past because history repeats And so it's like she's woven it throughout the story multiple times where, well, let's not worry about the past. Let's not, you know, bemoan that. Let's just look to the future. And then there will be some person who will say, but the future is the past. If we don't understand it, we're, quote, doomed to repeat it, right? So, and I've always been a big history buff with a strong belief. As you look through history, you're like, oh, they did it again and again. Oh, right. They did it again. And so you're like, okay, what are we going to do again? Or will we do it different? And I think right now you have so many educated people in the world that there's a lot of hope that maybe as we move forward in the next 10, 20, 30 years, we might actually as a species do things differently than previous collapses of empires and things like that. And so when I was reading through your book and flipping through it and stuff, I was being tantalized and excited by the stories of what was happening in all those earlier decades and reflecting upon how we right now could learn from what worked while maybe also recognizing what didn't work and choosing to do something different. For example, right now, it's a big conversation on the island talking about the neonics that are being implicated in the deaths of a lot of pollinators, in particular bees. And you have information in here about the types of chemicals that were used previously and how they were used. And you had a really interesting story about apple peels. And I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about what used to happen to shed light on how different things are already from how they used to be.
Right. I know a little bit about that from talking to beekeepers. And I know a little bit about old pesticide and fertilizer use. The old farmers aren't particularly interested in talking about that, but I have heard from Kathy Wheaton, for instance, that back when they ran the Ace Hardware franchise in the 70s, they were bringing over 10 and 10, 10, 20, 20 and 10, 10, 10 fertilizers, very strong chemical fertilizers over here on the island by the truckload. I do know that the farmers in the strawberry fields used to use a product called Go West, which is a euphemism for be dead. They would soak apple peels, apple cores, and other food waste in a DDT liquid solution and then carry it out, the farmers and their kids, in buckets and go lay these next to these strawberry plants out in the rows to be a trap for insects that they didn't want on their strawberry plants.
Interesting.
Now, today we find that aberrant behavior. And the chemical companies realized that and have developed pesticides that are actually absorbed into the plants called systemics. And those rise up in the plants and infuse the plant. And then when bugs come and feast on them, they absorb some of those poisons and are sickened by them. Now, in the case of neonicotinoids, neonics for short, those are one of those infused through the plant poisons, and they've been shown to cause bees not to just drop dead immediately, but it confuses their nervous system. It causes them to be disoriented, to not find their way back to the hive. And a bee that can't find its way to the hive is a dead bee within a very short period of time. So they've been banned in Germany and Spokane and Eugene.
Well, I think also what they do, so one, they can get distracted, not make it back to the hive. Or they can be sprayed and sometimes oversprayed. So that happened recently, like in Portland. There were a bunch of dead bees all over the ground outside of an apartment complex, and people freaked out. It's because they had oversprayed the trees that were flowering at the time, of course. But then also, they carry it with them. So if I understand, when you see the pictures of beehives and there's dead bees all over, it can be because some bees fly to this person's house and they come back, but then it gets distributed to the whole hive. So it, as you say, it's an ongoing growth area with regard to science knowledge. And, you know, we're learning more as time passes.
And it's tough enough for bees on the island anyway. We have to deal, our bees have to deal with cold. They have to deal with moisture, which is a real killer. And all the problems that come with moisture, like funguses and molds. They have to deal with varroa mites and the Nosema fungus. And then add the poisons that we put on our out in our environment. So all those things contribute to stressing the hives and making them much weaker. Incidentally, you ask about the history. Back in the 70s, bees were used as trackers of the arsenic that was coming out of the smelter in Reston. There was a Montana college professor who developed a study using honeybees to see how far spread was the smelter plume that rose right. out of Tacoma.
Right.
Where did it go? How far did it affect animals? And how they did that was they took samples from beehives in the suspected plume track and saw the concentrations. And what they discovered is that there was a reason that beehives were having a terrible time on the south end of Vashon Island
oh.
is because of the smelter. Concentrations of arsenic and cadmium were too high.
Right, right, right.
So bees really are carriers, like the canary
yep.
in the coal mine.
Yep. Yeah, good, good indicators of what's going on.
Right. Now, myself, there is a dialogue going on right now between advocates of banning neonics altogether
mm-hmm.
and people who would like to either continue to have access to them or who point out that without those, you go to worse chemicals and people will resort to worse chemicals than the neonics.
So does that mean that 6 years ago, the chemicals that were like the best chemicals in the market were, you know, a certain level of bad. Let's say they were like, you know, 9 on a scale of 10, and that neonics came along as believed to be maybe 7 on a scale of 0 to 10, and they were considered to be better. And we've had this unfortunate discovery to find out that actually they're causing this unintended consequence, which is the hallmark of humanity.
Right, right. You put them, and you put the drugs inside the plant instead of sprinkling them or spraying them on the exterior of the plant where your children, dogs or cats or birds would rub up against them and be
right.
sickened by them.
Interesting. Well, and so, okay. So once again, by doing so in your book, people will sort of get a taste of all the different ways in which humans have tried to interact with their environment over how many decades do you cover?
Well, in the book, I
and
cover.
And I know that's just a pea. That's a small sliver
right,
of what shows
right.
up. You have many stories in your book as well.
Right. The book covers the history back to the beginning of the Ice Age, 14,000 years ago, to show how Vashon was formed and how
right.
our geology was laid down by the Vashon Glacier. There's also a chapter 2 that talks about the early homesteading practices, which
right.
is an introduction to why we have so many old apple trees, because many of them are heritage trees from that time.
Mm-hmm.
And my book talks about how you could restore them. Or
mm-hmm.
why you might want to take care of them, including a really good rescue story about one that fell down at Monument Farm that I called the Tire Swing King, which is still productive despite being hauled back on its roots
wow.
on its feet after falling over in an ice storm several years ago.
Oh, the big one.
The big one,
oh,
yes.
My
the
gosh.
Tire Swing King keeled over in an ice storm, but
oh.
this was a tree that was probably planted in the 1890s.
Right.
The grandfather of the first family to come to the island, Salmon Sherman, came out from New York, did grandpa, bought some land, planted trees, as you were supposed to comply with homesteading requirements.
Mm-hmm.
And then he sold out and went back to New York and died. But his trees, of course, lived on.
Right.
And this tree is thought to be one of them. I talked to Gene Sherman,
oh.
and he was pretty sure that the Tire Swing tree was one of his great-grandparents'
wow.
trees. So it's now in the hands of Joe Curliel and Tony Raguste, and when that tree keeled over, rather than sawed up for firewood, they called a local guy with a backhoe, and he and his daughter put guy wires on that thing and
pulled
winched
it back
up.
And
a year later, that thing yielded like 300 pounds of apples.
Oh, my God. Now, where's their property?
They're at the base of Monument Road, which
right,
is
right, on the left. They're making vineyards?
Oh, yes. They're the largest vineyard on the
okay.
island, probably. They came out with a Pinot Noir that Ron Irvine of Vashon Winery called his Holy Grail wine when
wow.
he first made the wine. And occasionally, they still do make a Pinot Noir wine in a good year.
Right.
Also, right to the east is the oldest vineyard still existing on the island, the Chugwala Vineyard, which used to be in the hands of Jim Stewart, who started
oh,
Stewart's Best
right,
Coffee.
Right.
Right. Now called Seattle's Best
mm-hmm.
Coffee. And that is a white grape wine called a Chasselet Doré that makes a spritzy white wine when the birds and the cows and the elk and the deer at
Let
Jim's property.
Let everybody else eat the grapes. Yeah, right.
Yeah, yeah. So very occasionally that yields enough wine to make a decent run of bottled wine.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah. And if that's
so you must drive around the island, you have a completely different experience than like 98% of us, because you're just like, you like know what's behind that bush over there and that trail that goes off, which I would imagine just disappears into a bunch of trees. And you know there's like some little mini valley there probably with amazing stuff going on that no one else on the main highway is going to know is there.
Well, it's true that since starting to write about gardening, I have met so many more people.
Yeah.
Gardeners and farmers are generally friendly, giving, generous people. Mm-hmm. And so it's a pleasure to drive down the highway waving to people who I pass on the cars or saying, oh, look, there are apple trees in full bloom.
Right.
So that's been a gift to me personally. The book has not only made given readers a bigger picture of the island, it's made me much more intimately aware of the island.
Yeah. And I'm going to take this moment to remind our listeners that you're currently tuned into The Voice of Vashon at 101.9 FM KVSH. This is Prose, Poetry, and Purpose. My name is March Twisdale, program host and director, and I'm currently speaking with Karen Dale, author of Garden on Vashon, a great source of island gardening know-how and lore. So there's the book, and you know what it actually contains and all that you've brought to your readers. But there's always that kernel or that inciting incident is what I like to talk about it as. Most writers, if you ask them, like, why did you write it? Or, you know, there's usually an inciting incident, maybe an experience. For you, you were talking about the giant ice storm and, you know, we got snowed in and lost electricity and you dove into your, you know, gardening books and Michael Pollan's book. And,
Michael Pollan's book, The Omnivore's Dilemma, was really a generating get off your ass and start writing kind of event.
Right. And your goal, though, for your readers, the underlying goal that you have for what you're hoping they will take away after reading this book.
Oh, well, I hope they will take away greater knowledge in how to do things in their own home place and also how to be better stewards of their own home place.
Right.
I mean, for instance, I included a water chapter. Now, water
seems... Nice. I'm glad you did that.
And that really does reach back toward into history to bring all the information into one place. Otherwise, to get a sense of why you can or cannot have a well or mm-hmm. why you can or cannot sprinkle on the island is lost in thick notebooks and file folders in the library.
Mm-hmm.
And so my goal was to bring all the reasons for our Vashon water policy into one place.
Right, and accessible, easy. I mean, one chapter in your book is not... You've obviously taken and gleaned what matters most out of all those giant, you know, notebooks.
Yeah.
And you've put it in one chapter.
Yeah. Like. And I don't laboriously bullet point every single one. I think I made the summation statement. After the car report followed a myriad of reports, 30 years worth, actually, of reports by King County and other water control entities to see how our water systems work here. But the goal of that, of course, is to show people why what they do matters.
Right.
Yes. For instance, there's a story in there about a woman who put too much horse manure on her garden. Now, that sounds like a really good thing to do, but she lived on the south end of the island where the soil perks really well, and her next well reading showed higher nitrates.
Right.
King County this last year did a thorough study about why Quartermaster Harbor was getting little deoxygenated. They wanted to know why there's rising nitrates in the water. Was it humans? Was it livestock? Was it boats? Was it what?
Mm-hmm.
And I highly anticipated that it would be failing septic systems. But apparently the greatest contributor to rising nitrate waters is rotting alder leaves. Why? Because we're no longer a farming community. We've let our forests come back in the last 100 years, and alders are everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So we often would like to point the fingers at our fellow humans, but in fact, sometimes the answer is not so simple.
Or those alder leaves wouldn't be a problem if we didn't have the failing septics. You know, sometimes it's like the person who says, oh, I'm allergic to cats. Well, if they're living in an environment where there's like 12 allergies going on that their body's dealing with, and then they walk in and they meet the cat and they have a huge reaction.
Oh, right.
And
right.
It's the tipping
camel's
point.
Back.
Yeah. And then a lot of people with allergies, they'll move. If you move like to another country or you move to a different area where the environment's very different, suddenly a multitude of allergies will go away. And you'll be like, why can I now pet cats, but I couldn't pet them here? And it's because in this place, maybe you were also battling with molds and other issues. You go to Arizona, the molds are gone, this and that are gone, and suddenly the cat doesn't push you over the edge anymore.
Well, I mean, that's true. So many problems that we have are compound problems. Uh-huh. I mean, look at the salmon issues in Oregon and Washington and, you know, for so long, there was finger pointing back and forth. The Indian tribe saying it's the fishermen saying it's the loggers right. saying it's the recreational fishermen,
right.
it's global warming, it's the seals. The truth is that
it's all of them.
That's the problem with the bees. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the problem with rising nitrates in the water. There are all these little factors that we all contribute to in very small ways to create avalanches mm-hmm. of really bad effects.
So sadly, we are running out of time. But there was a story, I think, you were talking about in the wine chapter, which I find fabulous for all of our listeners that are foodies out there. This book might be about gardening, but clearly it also has a wine chapter.
Oh,
and what
yes.
was it that you were telling me about that?
Well, you got me started when you're talking about history sort of leapfrogging on itself. Mm-hmm. And the wine chapter chronicles a history like that for the island. We had wine grapes probably since the very beginning. In fact, wine growing in Puget Sound started on an island, though not our own.
Mm-hmm.
But what I love to discover, for instance, is that one decade's effort, though abandoned, was later taken up by another. And there's a chain of passings off.
Right.
I mean, for instance, let me read you this little bit. There was a fellow, an islander named Les Street, in the 70s. Well, before the 70s, he had gone with his uncle to Maury Island to snoop state's seventh winery, the Hake Winery, mm-hmm. over there in Docton. And he, when he was an adult, he wanted to start a vineyard. So he drove to BC and managed to procure some very special cool weather vines from the station up there and came down and planted them on Maury Island. And he had to abandon it later.
Mm-hmm.
But in 1998, some guys on the island who were taking the Bainbridge Island Winery class from Gerard Bertrand, they went looking for a vineyard and discovered Les Street's vineyard in Maury Island. And they brought it back and were cropping from it for a little while.
Right.
Before moving on, and one of those guys, Steve Snyder, is now up in Hollywood Hills in the Marysville area with his own big vineyard.
Right.
So these things go hop, skipping, and jumping through our own time until, you know, even now we have Maury Island Vineyard with Bill Riley. We have Cliff Goodman doing Cliff's beer.
Right.
And we have our own distillery. So these efforts rise and fall and are handed off.
And they have a lasting, and they have a, it's like if a person sits in their house and they do a bunch of paintings and then they die and the paintings get sold off to someone, poof, it's like it can be gone. But if a person, if they're, what do you call when a person is painting their palette? If your palette is your land, and if you're out there painting on your land by planting these trees or this or that or whatever, when you move, when you sell the house, when you die, whatever happens, your art is there alive, living after you.
Right.
And, you know, that's, I mean, one
that's like Christopher Sherman's tree.
Yes.
That, you know, 100 years after it was planted, was treasured and rescued by the current owners. We do have a legacy of agriculture and good gardening here on the island. And if my book helps people be more aware of that, mm-hmm. more aware of the possibility of what lay before on their land and what they can do to take good care of it, then my book will have accomplished its goal.
Right, right. And especially as we look forward to the future and the gradual and continuous change that's occurring in society and our resource change that's occurring. You know, it's like if we want to survive, we're going to need to regain some of those skills and some of that knowledge about how to, I mean, they used to save potatoes, right? The building where Pandora's Pets is right now used to have like all these giant bins where they had all these potatoes on the island that were stored in sawdust. And then people would get their, you know, no one really does that anymore. Now we buy potatoes in bags that are shipped from another state. But at some point when fossil fuels are more expensive and we can't be living off of the food of the globe and we need to live more off the food of our land locally, these types of pieces of information need to be regained.
Yeah.
Yeah. We are literally building the future in the present every day.
Well, it's always good for people to know how to grow their own food.
Right. And I think you've done a great job of making that sound fun, accessible, doable.
And part of an island tradition.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Well, thank you so much, Karen, for taking the time to come up here to the studio and talk with me and share your thoughts and your book and your many years of labor with our island and all of your readers.
Well, thank you. Thank you for a stimulating conversation.
Yay. All righty. And I'll see you at the farmer's market.
Okay.
And that concludes my interviews for this month. Thanks for listening to the wealth of insight and information that these two local authors, Melissa McCann and Karen Dale, have brought to us. And now I'd like to share with you one more journal entry from my flash fiction series, Vashon After the Change. For those of you just tuning in, flash fiction is a small speck of a moment in a larger story that can be served up solo and is generally expected to fall under 1,000 words, with 750 being a popular average. The premise of my Vashon After the Change series is this. One day, in the middle of a northwestern summer night, a veil of fog descended over the waters surrounding Vashon Island, cutting us off from the rest of the world. What happened next is what the series is all about. And here is, for your listening pleasure, journal entry number 200 and something, titled Vashon After the Change, Butchering Day. When my parents decided to buy the property, the plum tree was an overgrown mass, shrouding itself in limbs that drooped under the deadly weight of superfluous branches, their tips pressing into the dirt, competing with the roots for territory. Before unpacking even the kitchen dishes, and despite the cold December air, my mom took an entire day to ruthlessly cut away 70% of its mass, exposing slanted inner trunks to the icy breath of winter and the light of short days. She was always like that, a purger to my dad's clutterer tendencies, a minimalist in a world of more, more, more. Now, a pile of chicken heads lay amongst blades of midsummer grass as she, my dad, my brother, and I cull last year's flock by a similar 70% or more. Before the change, my brother would keep at mom as soon as she told her dad to, quote, take the boys out for the morning, before speak for butchering day. I hate you, he'd state, eyes alight and feet solidly planted in the dusty path leading to the aptly named Chicken Village. I won't let you. Now he helps. He understands what she meant when she said, they're big birds, honey. We love them and we give them the best life a chicken could ever have, but we can't keep them once they stop laying. It would be wasteful. Even he understands that thrift is, once again, the greatest of virtues. I stare down at shiny, dead, black eyes, ragged red gashes, where just yesterday their flexible necks had twisted and turned as they lay drugged by the summer sun, or vigorously preened their feathers while burrowing into chicken-sized holes full of mite-destroying grit and dust. Leaning down, I grasp smooth opal-blue feet and plunge the heavy body into our largest speckled gray and black canning pot, dipping and pulling so that the near-boiling water will work its magic as it loosens and drenches her soft, peachy-gray feathers, making her ready for plucking, gutting, and trading. Our feathered currency. Before the change, we culled once a year and pulled the girls from the freezer whenever soupy inspiration hit. Now, we cull 3 times a year, a bloody, necessary ritual followed by an orgy of chicken stew, chicken salad, chicken legs, wings, hearts, gizzards, even feet, until the 4 we get to keep are gone. No freezers made it through the change, and they are not the only things that got left behind. That became myth, story, remembrance, and instant history. I found another one, my brother cries, holding up a perfectly formed egg, its shell soft blue like the legs of its dead mother. With a clink, he sets it carefully into our grandmother's ceramic bowl, bright yellow on the outside, pure white on the inside, like the unborn nestled within it. My mouth waters. Tonight, I'll be sent out to the garden for our usual dinner of well-matured vegetables. No longer do we pick them young and soft. One more change. And since I'm the best, I'll get the job and the opportunity to graze unnoticed as I search for bolted greens, bitter yet filling, and only the largest zucchinis, swollen and elongated like the pony when he pees. Garlic snapes, onion greens, and fully rounded out peas and beans will tonight include the glowing bowlful of creamy yolks. Mama, this hen had 7 yolks inside of her. My brother's fingers glisten in the dappled sunlight, cupping loose orange globes. Did you kill a pullet by accident? Mom asks, her hands expertly disemboweling the second-to-last hen in under 30 seconds. No, he whispers, pouring soft, never-shelled yolks into grandmother's bowl. She was a good layer, that's all. He doesn't name them anymore. Or if he does, he keeps it to himself. Or maybe, I think, he just got hungry enough. Our trade agreement is clear and strict. We trade away all the eggs and 90% of the meat in exchange for lye, half a pig, 4 new to us pairs of shoes each fall, hay for winter, 6 bottles of potato vodka, and a tub of lotion infused with marijuana extract. Nature's cure-all. It's a good deal, if a bit light on the protein. I lean over under branches thick with swelling green plums and gaze hungrily at the soft yolks, descending in size from ping-pong balls to malt balls, marbles, blueberries, and finally, tiny clusters of creamy orange BBs. A diet of grass, bugs, seeds, and wriggling earthworms gorged upon on manure turning days all make for yolks more orange than yellow, more thick than thin, and secretly plentiful on butchering days. Change is the only constant, our mom used to say. Now, the change is what defines us. This is an original work copyrighted by March Twisdale. Any rebroadcast, retransmission, or transcriptions of this piece is expressly forbidden without the written permission of the author. And that's our show, folks. Once again, you are listening to Voice of Vashon at 101.9 FM, KVSH. This is March Twisdale, program host and producer of Prose, Poetry, and Purpose, the show where authors share how they hope to inspire positive change in the world, one reader at a time. And now, I'll close with our island's own Cami Lundeen and her title song, Run Free, one more example of inspiration through art.
Like the wild horse runs in the mountains, like the sun sets beyond the sea, like the wind blows through the trees on a crisp autumn evening, wild and free. It can't be caught, it can't be tamed, it cannot be held still. It can't be touched, it can't be felt, it can't be stolen away. Run free and be who you were made to be. Run wild and find the beauty that hides inside, that hides inside. Like the moon floats in the clouds above, like the bird soars in the endless sky, like the thunder that rolls out of sight on a stormy night. Wild.